This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Al Gore has been staying on the sidelines in the Democratic primary. He's a superdelegate who has not yet endorsed a candidate. This morning, I spoke with the Nobel Peace Prize winner and former vice president and senator about the primary, the proposed gas tax holiday, and several other issues. He was in London. The occasion for the interview is the paperback publication of his book, The Assault on Reason, which is about what has gone wrong in our democracy and how he thinks we can fix it. Al Gore, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Good to be here.
The two biggest states remaining in the Democratic primary vote today. You've been keeping quiet about the primary. You haven't made an endorsement. What's your intention in remaining on the sidelines for now?
Well, we scheduled this book interview long before I or almost anyone else felt that the Democratic contest would still be going on this late. My purpose in not endorsing a candidate is nothing elaborate. I'm simply watching and listening to the campaign. As a delegate to the convention, I will cast my vote at the proper time. I haven't ruled out making an endorsement prior to that time, but I haven't been moved to do so. I have respect for both candidates, and they both have strengths, and I'm simply listening and watching like a lot of people.
Okay, speculation is that you're trying to remain neutral right now in case you are needed as a party elder to step in and help referee a conclusion to a race that seems like it might be inconclusive.
Well, I don't like that phrase, party elder. A woman came up to me in a restaurant not long ago and said, "You know, if you dyed your hair black, you would look just like Al Gore." I said, "Well, thank you, ma'am." She said, "You sound like him, too." And so I'm not anxious to be playing that role of a party elder. I just turned 60, which is the new 59. And so I'm just a voter and a recovering politician and watching it carefully.
So you don't think you're going to be called on to step in at some point?
Well, I don't know that that role really exists. I've heard a lot of speculation that the superdelegates, perhaps in capes, will come and rescue this lingering process, but actually, it's designed to allow the voters to determine the outcome. And even though it has gone on much longer than is normal in the age of primaries and caucuses, nevertheless, I think the odds are overwhelming that it will tip rather decisively in one direction or another before the convention even meets.
Because the superdelegates have so much power in this current primary. Some Democrats think that the superdelegate system should be abandoned after this election and have it be more of a direct vote. What do you think?
It should be reexamined, but I prefer to wait till this is over and get a full picture of how it has worked. I think it's premature to I guess there's widespread dissatisfaction with the whole idea of having so many so-called superdelegates, but maybe that will be the prevailing view when this cycle is over, but I'd prefer to wait and see.
Florida and Michigan aren't being counted in the primary because they violated the DNC rules and jumped ahead in the primary schedule. A lot of people in those states are very angry about not having their votes counted. You know, I'm thinking, like, after the Florida recount, you're especially sensitive to Florida voters feeling disenfranchised. Do you think there would have been a way of punishing state party leaders instead of punishing voters in how Florida and Michigan were handled?
Well, I guess that the party rules are there for a purpose, to ensure the order and integrity of the process, and at some point, the party has to decide to enforce those rules. I'm sympathetic with Chairman Dean, and I think, in fairness to him and others, everyone sort of assumed that by this stage in the process, there would be a nominee and ample opportunity to go back and find remedies for the lack of participation by voters in Florida and Michigan. And yet, here we are. And in Florida, it's interesting, if I'm not mistaken, the congressional delegation and elected officials supporting both of the remaining candidates unanimously came to the conclusion that they did not want to try and do the contest over. I gather there was a good deal of concern about whether or not they could manage the process in such a short period of time. There may yet be an opportunity to go back and fix this before the convention, and in one way or another, they'll be seated. There will be delegations from both states. There's no doubt about that.
What do you think the fairest way of reconciling this would be?
Oh, I don't know. I'll leave that to the
party elders.
Democratic, the party elders. Thank you. Yes, with more gray hairs than me.
My guess is Al Gore and his book, The Assault on Reason, has just been published in paperback. Do you worry, as some Democrats do, that this very intense primary race and this very long primary race is ultimately weakening the party because of all the money and all the ammunition the two Democratic candidates are using against each other?
Well, it could be. We'll know later on in the year. It could be that it's reached the stage where damage to the eventual nominee, whichever of them that turns out to be, has reached a point that will be difficult to repair. But I'm not sure that's the case. There's a big pendulum in American politics that favors the party that has been out of power in the White House for 8 years, if there is a two-term incumbent. And that pendulum is swinging in favor of the Democratic nominee this year. And one manifestation will be a very powerful urge toward unity, no matter the divisiveness of the nominating contests. And I would not underestimate the healing power of that desire to win on the part of Democrats from all parts of the party. But I must confess, I don't really know the answer to your question. It could well be that even with that urge to heal, it may have reached the point where this damage is serious. But I don't know.
If so, that would be such a source of frustration to Democrats who feel that this year, President Bush has become so unpopular. Many Democrats feel this year should be an easy win. This presidential campaign should be an easy win for them, but it might not be because of all of the attacks in the primary and the prolonged primary.
And also because Senator McCain has cultivated an image as something of a maverick and an outsider where the Republican Party is concerned. I think he's put that image at risk by embracing President Bush's policies so wholeheartedly. But you're right, it would be a source of frustration for many Democrats if divisiveness or in the primaries and any other cause led to a feeling that the natural, what many believe should be the natural corrective course of events here in 2008 was not going to play out. My guess is that the Democratic nominee will retain a very powerful advantage, no matter who's nominated, because of the record of the incumbent combined with the eight-year tenure. Now, I must caution you and your listeners, Terry, that I have recently begun to fear that I'm losing my objectivity on President Bush and Vice President Cheney. And so you must take whatever I say about them with a grain of salt.
Yes, you lost a whole lot of that objectivity in your book, The Assault on Reason, which...
Well, I don't know.
just one more question about primaries. You ran in your share of primaries and, of course, ran for president. Are there different rules of engagement for a primary contest than a presidential campaign where you're running against someone from the opposite party? Is there usually an understanding of how much artillery is okay to use against members of your own party as opposed to against someone from the other party?
Oh, I think these contests look and feel the same from the inside. But yes, there is a felt obligation to show restraint in battling against the member of one's own party. But there's a felt obligation toward restraint in the general election contest if the rancor one might otherwise be vulnerable to would be damaging to the country. I guess when you balance them out, by and large, you'll see a little more restraint in the primaries. But it depends on the candidate, doesn't it?
My guest is Al Gore. His book, The Assault on Reason, has just been published in paperback. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Al Gore, and the occasion for his visit is the publication in paperback of his book, The Assault on Reason. Your book is in part about how America's public discourse has become less reasoned. You write, American democracy is now in danger. Reason has been withdrawn from the public sphere, and the resulting vacuum has been filled by fear, superstition, ideology, deception, intolerance, and obsessive secrecy. Give me one example of what you mean by that.
Well, the day before the United States Senate voted to invade Iraq, our longest-serving Senator, Senator Robert Byrd, stood on the floor of the Senate and asked poignantly, why is this chamber empty? Why are these halls silent? And in pointing out that the nation's greatest deliberative body was about to make one of the most important decisions it would ever face, a choice between war and peace, very few, if any, were present to hear the speeches. And the role of reasoned discourse played a much smaller role than our founders would have imagined. And on that day, public opinion polls showed that more than three-quarters of the American people, as of that moment, genuinely believed that the person primarily responsible for attacking us on September 11, 2001, was Saddam Hussein. And, of course, he had absolutely nothing to do with it. Bad as he was not involved in that attack. And the fact that more than three-quarters of our fellow citizens had been led to believe, and did believe, that this war was, among other things, a justifiable act of revenge against someone who had attacked us when it was not, that serves as an example of how reasoned discourse, the best evidence, a reliance on facts and debate, played less of a role than it should and that our founders assumed that it would. And we got into deep, deep trouble as a result.
Why do you think there was less debate in the Senate than there should have been about the war?
Well, I think that the images of the towers falling down, coupled with repeated and organized assertions by the administration and their spokesman implying a linkage between Saddam Hussein and the attack, had its predicted effect. And I think that the Senate chamber was empty that day because most of the senators were somewhere else. They were in fundraisers, many of them, collecting money that they could use to buy the 30-second television advertisements that are now the principal vehicle for our reelection campaigns. And that's a feature of the television age. And television is, even with the ascendancy of the internet, by far the dominant medium in our society. And part of the thesis in this book, Terry, is that our Constitution was written during the Age of Reason, which was defined by the printing press, and our founders assumed that printed words by free presses protected by the Bill of Rights against any censorship or encroachment by government action would ensure a well-informed citizenry. And in a public marketplace of ideas dominated by the television medium, there's reason to worry that reason itself plays less of a role, and these advertisements, which are linked to having enough money to buy the advertisements and the 30 seconds with which to air them. And so money plays a much bigger role and reason plays a smaller role.
In your book, you write about how President Bush has greatly expanded executive power. And President Bush has signed an unprecedented number of signing statements attached to legislation that he signed. And, you know, the way this works is President Bush can sign a bill into law and then attach a separate statement that he signed saying that all or part of this bill the president considers to be unconstitutional and encroachment on his executive power, and therefore he will decide not to follow all or part of the bill that he's just signed, virtually vetoing the bill without vetoing it. So what does that mean for the next president? Is the next president supposed to follow President Bush's signing statement, or does that just apply to President Bush? I don't really understand what kind of precedent that sets for the next president.
Well, it's extra constitutional. It's not really legal. It's not constitutional.
The signing statements in general?
Correct. Well, they have a limited role. It is not a new device, but what is new in this administration is the ridiculous extreme to which this has been taken, and the arrogance with which this president has asserted the right to unilaterally, as one person, overturn acts of Congress that have been enacted according to the Constitution. And even Supreme Court decisions. That's really a violation of the spirit as well as the letter of the American Constitution.
Let me give you an example of what I'm really unsure of. One of the signing statements that President Bush issued, and you cite this one in your book, has to do with the so-called McCain Amendment that prevented what this amendment defined as torture, as well as cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of detainees. It passed with enough votes to override a veto. So what President Bush did after signing the bill into law is he wrote a signing statement saying that he didn't have to follow this McCain Amendment because it violated what he thought was his constitutional powers. Correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong. So say John McCain was elected president. What would his options be in terms of dealing with President Bush's signing statement?
Well, the reason you're having trouble with it is that it's contrary to the American system. And in my view, not only would that signing statement not bind the next president, it is not legal as a statement of law where the current president is concerned. It is a raw assertion of authority outside the boundaries of the law.
But who would decide that it's officially legal or illegal? Nobody's officially thrown it out saying this is illegal.
Well, that's correct. And in our system, the ultimate arbiter of what is constitutional since Marbury versus Madison in the first decades of our republic has been the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court does not take all cases and has been often timid where this president's arrogation of authority to himself is concerned. But even where they have not been timid, where, for example, they ruled that the Clean Air Act requires President Bush and his EPA administrator to regulate global warming pollution as pollution under the Clean Air Act. And the executive branch has nonetheless refused to comply with the Supreme Court decision. And ultimately, the guarantor of our freedoms are the people. And these kinds of outrages, a president saying that he has the right to overturn George Washington's 200-plus year prohibition against torture and torture anyone he wants, with his assistants gathered in the basement of the White House, according to recent revelations, personally reviewing the kinds of torture techniques being used prisoner by prisoner. It's obscene.
Al Gore will be back in the second half of the show. His book, The Assault on Reason, has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Al Gore, Nobel Peace Prize winner and former vice president and senator. His book, The Assault on Reason, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded this morning. I'm really interested in where you stand on the issue of a gas tax holiday, since that's become such a big issue in the primary right now, and since you are so, our use of gas and oil is such a major issue for you. So what do you think?
Well, for almost 20 years now, I have formally proposed a massive shift in the system of taxation in the U.S., with a reduction in payroll taxes, taxes paid by employers and employees, and a new CO2 tax that makes up all the difference. The end result would not be a tax increase. It would be neutral in terms of the amount of revenue raised, but the effect would be to shift the incidence of taxation away from working people and away from employers and toward pollution. And CO2 is the most dangerous form of pollution we have today. 70 million tons of it will be put into the Earth's thin shell of atmosphere today, as if it's an open sewer.
So that would mean more tax on fuel.
But less tax on paychecks and on payrolls. With transition features that would allow an adjustment to this new system.
So you see this as a kind of consciousness-raising tax in a way?
Well, not only that, it's not just consciousness-raising. It has a direct impact on what we do. If you want to tax what you want less of, and you want to encourage what you want more of, we have for a long time now paid for our social welfare and health and public programs mainly through a payroll tax. And that's a system that was invented by Bismarck in the 19th century. And a lot of things have changed since then. And one of them is that the United States now competes in an IT-empowered, outsourced world with developing countries that have access to technology and skilled labor. And one of our biggest disadvantages has been our relatively high labor rates, which we don't want to decrease, but which we shouldn't want to make more of a disadvantage in international competition by piling on top of wage costs all of the costs of these social programs. We ought to pay for them with pollution taxes instead. And in the course of that, give an incentive to the reduction of CO2 and assist people with the adjustment toward a low-carbon, no-carbon economy that will make us much more competitive in the future.
So from what you said, would it be fair to assume that you think a gas tax holiday would set us, however briefly, in the opposite direction of where you think we should be heading in terms of what is taxed?
Well, I've tried to deal with this at a whole different level. I think that we need a massive change, and something like this is not even advertised as a serious policy change. It's intended as relief for people who are hit by higher gasoline prices. I would rather take the problem head on with this massive change with the CO2 tax and lowered payroll taxes.
Ethanol and the amount of farmland in the United States being devoted to growing corn for ethanol is now considered one of the major reasons for the global food crisis that we now have. Are there policies that you watched being created that you think helped lead to the position that we're in with corn and ethanol?
Well, I think that corn ethanol is at best a transition strategy toward the new generation of biofuels that don't compete with food crops at all. There is a sophisticated debate about why the food price crisis has suddenly blown up in the world. The drought in Australia, connected to global warming in the view of many, took the largest grain flows out of the world markets, and that touched off some protectionist measures with countries hoarding grain. And the introduction of leverage or speculation in commodities has had a lot to do with it as well. But there's no doubt that at least on the margins, the amounts of corn being used for ethanol have had some impact. But there's a major debate on how to go about this in an environmentally and economically sensible way, and I think that's a useful debate. Most people come out when they really look at all the facts by saying, look, some of these fuels are bad and some of them are good. We shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's concentrate on developing the next generation that have positive consequences.
You know, in your book, you mentioned that you think Hurricane Katrina convinced Americans to look differently at climate crisis.
Some.
Even though no one can say for sure whether Katrina was directly a result of the climate crisis or not. But, you know, one reaction to Katrina, one now famous reaction, was from Pastor John Hagee, whose endorsement John McCain sought.
Mm-hmm.
And on our show about Hurricane Katrina, he said, all hurricanes are acts of God because God controls the heavens. I believe that New Orleans had a level of sin that was offensive to God, and they were recipients of the judgment of God for that. I believe that Hurricane Katrina was, in fact, the judgment of God against the city of New Orleans. And he went on to explain that this was punishment for a gay pride parade that was about to happen that promised to reach a level of sexuality never demonstrated before in all of the gay pride parades. So what do you think about when you hear a reaction like that to Katrina?
Well, my friends in New Orleans said, well, if that's the case, how come God spared the French Quarter? of course, that's silly. It's also important to note that the emerging consensus among the climate scientists is that even though any individual storm can't be linked to singularly to global warming, we've always had hurricanes. Nevertheless, the trend toward more Category 5 storms, the larger ones, and the trend towards stronger and more destructive storms appears to be linked to global warming, and specifically to the impact of global warming on higher ocean temperatures in the top couple hundred feet of the ocean, which drives convection energy and moisture into these storms and makes them more powerful. And as we're talking today, Terry, the death count in Myanmar from the cyclone that hit there yesterday has been rising from 15,000 to way on up there to much higher numbers now being speculated. And last year, a catastrophic storm last fall hit Bangladesh. The year before, the strongest cyclone in more than 50 years hit China. And we're seeing consequences that scientists have long predicted might be associated with continued global warming. And the entire North Polar ice cap, normally the size of the lower 48 states, give or take in Arizona, is melting before our eyes. 40% melted in the last 20 years. And in the summer months, it could be completely gone, according to one scientific estimate, in as little as 5 years.
You know what confuses some people? For some people, they say, well, where I live, it's been cooler this year. It's been a cold winter, so therefore there's not global warming.
Yeah, well, this has been the hottest winter. Well, several of the months this winter have been the hottest in the history of the world. And, of course, the United States is only a small percentage of the globe's surface. And one challenge in responding to the climate crisis is that it is global in nature. And it's the average temperature worldwide that brings these consequences. The seasons are getting mixed up. The animals and plants are finding themselves pushed out of their niches. The extinction rate is being elevated to very dangerous levels. We're seeing deeper droughts and, ironically, at the same time, stronger, more destructive floods because there's more moisture evaporating off the oceans into warmer air and more of it falls at one time. But the soil moisture evaporates more readily because of the increase in average temperatures. And this has a destructive impact that is unprecedented and devastating and must be arrested. And in order for us to solve the climate crisis, we have got to find a way to reason together about these complex facts that the scientists are now agreed on. And these propagandistic efforts by some of the largest carbon polluters to convince people to say, oh, well, it was cold this week, so there's no global warming, or to take some other head-in-the-sand approach, that is self-interested and wrong. And we the people, have to find a way to reason together on the basis of the facts.
In your book, you despair about how public discourse has been kind of cheapened and overwhelmed by innuendo and disinformation, and everything's like a TV commercial. You're using TV commercials now as part of your environmental work through the Alliance for Climate Protection. You have a series of TV ads, which are kind of funny, in which you've teamed up, you know, conservatives and liberals, people like Pat Robertson and Al Sharpton, Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich, and they basically come on and say, we disagree about everything except for one thing, and that's the importance of protecting the environment. What made you think that you should be doing an ad campaign? Because you're so critical about how advertising is turning our discourse into sound bites.
Well, in the normal course of events, I'm optimistic about how this is going to turn out, and I don't despair about the current trend. I predict that if we keep the internet free from dominance and control, it will evolve in a way that re-empowers individuals to play the role that American citizens are supposed to play in reinvigorating our democracy. I think that there are good times ahead, but I think that transition is going to happen too slowly to solve the climate crisis. So we have to use every means at our disposal in order to get the word out about the nature of the climate crisis and the need to react quickly. The leading scientists have begun to say that we may have only a few years until we cross a kind of point of no return beyond which it would be so difficult to reverse this process that we'd have far less of a chance to do it. So getting these policies changed quickly worldwide is an urgent priority.
My guest is Al Gore. His book, The Assault on Reason, has just been published in paperback. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Al Gore, and the occasion for his visit is the paperback publication of his book, The Assault on Reason. I want to get back to political discourse for a minute. In your book, you mentioned that your father was in one of his reelection campaigns. He was called an atheist. He was called unpatriotic.
Mm-hmm.
And he lost the election. Why was he called an atheist and unpatriotic?
He was in favor of the constitutional provision that protects us against the mingling of governmental power and organized religion. One of the bedrocks of America's founding was the insulation of religion against government interference, and the flip side of that is the protection against the cynical mixing of a particular denominational approach with government authority. And so the separation of church and state, as it's usually referred to in shorthand, was a principle that he supported, and that led him to oppose a constitutional amendment that would overturn that prohibition and allow particular denominations to put into the public schools their preferred doctrinal instruction. And that was used by his opponents. He's hardly the only one.
And the unpatriotic, I think, was because he opposed the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, Tennessee is the volunteer state. That goes back to Andy Jackson and the War of 1812. But we're particularly proud of serving our country in time of war, and many Southern states have a similar attitude, and that's something to be proud of. But when the Vietnam War was prosecuted on false pretenses, and we now know, of course, that the Gulf of Tonkin was based on fabricated evidence, and we stepped into the shoes of the British and French in a complicated situation there that we just didn't know what we were getting into. And that's ancient history by now, but he was on the Foreign Relations Committee and was one of the earliest voices raised in opposition to what he thought was a misguided policy.
So what did you take away from this? What did you take away from his experiences being labeled an atheist and unpatriotic and losing as a result?
Well, I was very proud of him for his courage and for his willingness to stand on principle and fight for the right. I'm proud of his service over 32 years. I miss him. He and my mother both were heroes to me in their devotion to American democracy, and the positive memories far outweigh the pain our family went through in seeing him defeated in a way that we thought was unjust. But that's just a part of the battles that are inherent in democracy.
Paul Krugman, in October of 2007, wrote, "What is it about Mr. Gore that drives right-wingers insane? The biggest reason they hate Mr. Gore, in his case, the smear campaign has failed. He's taken everything they could throw at him and emerged more respected and more credible than ever, and it drives them crazy." Your comment.
Thank you, Paul Krugman. I think he's a brilliant columnist. I don't always agree with him, but I think that particularly when he looks at economic issues, he's just brilliant. And you won't be surprised that I think that particular sentence was brilliant.
Finally, you know, a lot of people have had these scenarios that if the race ends up being very problematic and hard to resolve, the Democratic primary race, that somehow you're brought in and and you resolve the problem by, through the superdelegates doing their thing, you become the Democratic candidate and one of the two current contenders become vice president. Has anybody ever talked to you about that during the long primary?
Well, that is in a year of remote contingencies, that's about as remote as you could possibly imagine. And again, as I said earlier, there's no doubt in my mind that well before the convention assembles in Denver, during the time between the last primary in June and the last 10 days of August, there will be a nominee before the convention ever meets.
Well, thank you again for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Terry.
Al Gore's book, The Assault on Reason, has just been published in paperback. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.